You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of August 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence. It has no place in America.
A day after grudgingly reading out the condemnation he should have made 2 days earlier, U.S. President Donald Trump returns to business as usual, brawling online with enemies real and much more often imagined. My guests John Everard and Jonathan Fenby will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including North Korea's decision to postpone turning the South China Sea into a lake of fire, the 70th anniversary of independence for India and for Pakistan, and does it matter if Berlin's waiters, bartenders and baristas can't actually speak German? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are John Everard, former UK ambassador to North Korea, among other postings, and Jonathan Fenby, former editor of the South China Morning Post, now chairman of China Research and director of European Political Research at T.S. Lombard. Welcome both. And we will start with John's former bailiwick of North Korea, the leader of which, Kim Jong-un, appears to be rowing back his threat to use the U.S. territory of Guam as target practice. The North Korean state news agency, KCNA, said that Kim had reviewed the plan, but was postponing a final decision pending the next move by, quote, the foolish Yankees, unquote. This bulletin was accompanied by a nice picture of Kim earnestly regarding a big map. John, has Kim backed down?
He's not quite backed down. The North Koreans have actually been very clever over this. The original statement talking about firing missiles, not actually at Guam, but to splash down in the sea around
in the
Guam,
general vicinity.
In the general vicinity. Was carefully crafted so that the North Korean military were going to draw up a plan and advise the senior leader, and Kim Jong-un himself was going to take the final decision. So they never actually committed themselves to the launch. And I think they've worked out that some of the American rhetoric has dropped back a bit. The Americans haven't actually done anything. They've just sort of banged the table and shouted a bit. So they've decided that they can, with honour, simply not press their own button. But the Korean version of the article is actually quite fierce and talks about, you know, if the Americans so much as sneeze, more or less, wham, bang, you know, off we go. Nevertheless, this is a real cooling of the temperature. Apparently people in Guam are breathing a bit easier, and I suspect people in Pyongyang are as well.
The thing is, though, Jonathan, Donald Trump, when he gets around to noticing this, will portray it as a triumph in the way that he portrays literally everything that goes even slightly right as a personal triumph for him. And indeed, in fairness, the governor of Guam, Eddie Calvo, said he thought that Trump's saber-rattling had in fact clarified matters. Has there been something to be said for, as Rex Tillerson had it, talking to Kim Jong-un in language he understood?
Well, I'm sure Trump will say that, and in a sense, that's a danger.
I'm very surprised he hasn't already.
Exactly, because we may get a triumphalist tweet from him, which will then annoy Mr. Kim quite considerably. But John, I would agree entirely. I think the North Koreans have played this really quite cleverly, and so on, and they've kept the threat there, the menace is there, but it's, you know, which is on the middle burner now, perhaps not the very front, but certainly I don't think the very back. And we'll have the South Korean-American military exercises on, I think, August the 21st, which will start, which could be accompanied, there's a lot of talk in Washington about a big show of force, even more than usual, and that could set off a new round in this. So we're in a kind of smouldering crisis here, where the flame may have slightly gone down, but to mix my metaphors terribly, I don't think we're out of hot water.
Just as a point there, the North Korean statement, it loses quite a lot in translation. The original Korean makes it idea that it would only be an American action that would trigger a launch. So Trump can tweet all he likes. They've said effectively they're just going to maintain a proper hauteur and ignore all that.
So, John, is this then North Korea effectively choosing to retain control of the situation? Is it analogous, I guess I'm asking, to the frozen conflicts, as they're called, that Russia has established and operates in Georgia and in Ukraine? They're always there. And any time that Russia decides it is in its interest to wind everybody up or put everybody off guard, it can do exactly that.
Yes, there may be elements of that. Also, of course, remember we're looking at a moving target, that all the time we're talking, all the time that Trump and Kim Jong-un are shouting at each other, the North Korean nuclear and missile programs move forward. Absolutely. And the experts are saying sometime late this year, sometime perhaps early next year, they will have the capability of delivering a nuclear warhead to a US coastal city. At that stage, I think the game pops up again.
Jonathan, there has been other dynamics swirling around this, at least the ones we know about. South Korea has urged the United States to de-escalate. They hosted the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General John Dunford, yesterday. President Moon Jae-in has also been insisting that the consent of South Korea is a precursor to any action by the United States. And also we have seen China extend its ban on North Korean imports. Have those things been significant?
Well, you can paint, which I don't personally go along with, because I've been pretty pessimistic about this whole situation for the last year or so, and I think it will get worse before it gets any better. You could, however, I was thinking of that this morning on the bus going into the office, you could paint a hopeful scenario out of this, that actually if you take together the UN vote on sanctions, China putting sanctions on imports of iron ore and seafood, the North Koreans and all that, you could say that actually Kim has stepped back from the conflict, and now that is going to open up the way for some kind of contact, some kind of negotiations. The trouble is, and John will know this better than I think, but I think every possible way out, every possible thing to talk about is ruled out by one side or the other here.
Yes, and indeed, one thing that the North Koreans have made very clear at the highest level is they're not going to talk. This will not end in negotiations. There's a special form of words produced by Kim Jong-un himself after the July the 4th launch, which has been repeated, I think, half a dozen times now in the North Korean media, saying effectively, we will only talk if the Americans drop their hostile policy, which turns out to mean effectively American denuclearization, which is kind of unlikely.
And which, of course, Trump, I mean, every time he tweets, that is ammunition to say we are facing the hostile imperialism of the United States and go back to the Korean War.
Confrontation maniacs, I believe, is the preferred locution. Certainly,
I'm sure there's some more highfalutin psychological term for that.
Certainly at Rodong Sinmun. That's still a favourite of theirs, I notice. John, finally on this, what is the... Is there something, I guess if we can call it encouraging or positive, that the United States can infer from this? Can they infer a recognition on Kim's part that there is a red line and that the United States is actually serious about massive retaliation should he step over it?
Not clear they can infer even that. I mean, clearly the United States has the hardware to do this, but the North Koreans harbour deep doubts about real US will to get drawn into a conflict which might end up quite seriously in the obliteration of one or more US cities. They tend to rather look down on the Americans as kind of weak-kneed or capitalist so-and-sos, and they think that Trump's an idiot. They may not be entirely alone in that. So, no, I don't think we can draw that. One very important bit of progress we have seen, though, is that China is coming to the view that the present situation is untenable, that as long as we have North Korea and America facing off, China's interests are at risk. And a lot of the Chinese commentary revolves around possible alternative scenarios, different ways of organising the Korean Peninsula, which can only be good.
Well, let's look now at the United States, the president of which has been on social media again today, retweeting, apparently accidentally, someone calling him a fascist, less accidentally, a cartoon of a train mowing down a CNN journalist, arguably somewhat tactless in present circumstances, and something insane by a conspiracy theorist. These have all since been deleted, but have provided further cause for gratitude that the nuclear button is not literally a button. This follows, of course, Trump's ill-tempered recital of a statement condemning white supremacist racism roughly 48 hours after such a thing might have passed as sincere. Jonathan, four, last I checked, CEOs have now quit his manufacturing council in protest. The question being, I guess, at this point, why haven't the rest of them?
Well, because they, you know, it's still the old thing of being received at court of the president. You may think this is in your personal interest, makes you feel big, and is in your company's interest. But certainly you can see the negative feedback that it's having with the CEOs who have distanced themselves. And a lot of others have really, after the Paris, after pulling out of the climate change, Paris climate change, a lot of other people at CEO level have pulled back from the administration, I think. But this, you know, this incident, it just brings up the whole question again of A, where Trump sees his real support as being, and where his instincts are.
John, what do we learn from the contrast if we measure the speed with which he rubbished these decamping CEOs, or grandstanders, as he called them, and the rather, well, lesser speed with which he condemned neo-Nazis and the Ku Klux Klan?
I suspect that the answer is Steve Bannon, that Steve Bannon intervened to whisper in his ear, or to scream hysterically into his ear, which is rather more Steve Bannon style, not to condemn these sensible white folk protecting their heritage, as Steve Bannon would probably see it. There was no such brakes applied on Trump's denunciations of CEOs who departed his business council. You said four just now. We're at least seven. We had three depart early this year.
Since Saturday.
Since Saturday, yes, that's right. No, but this is part of an ongoing hemorrhage, and one wonders how many business leaders will now rush forward to take these people's places. It's starting to smell very bad. I can't think of any Republican president who's had such trouble with a body which traditionally has been a bulwark of support for Republican presidents.
You would think. I mean, yeah. Jonathan, the four CEOs, unless any more have handed in their cards while we've been on air, but the four CEOs we know about are those of Merck, Under Armour, Intel, and the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Are we going to reach a point, or have we perhaps reached that point? And you know, it's not impossible, of course, that the CEO of a major business can have a genuine conscience, and may just think, I cannot associate with this man for reasons of principle. But are we going to reach a point at which being seen to be associated with Trump, the Trump brand, if you will, is bad for business?
Yes, I mean, I think we're getting towards that point. I mean, the head of Merck said it was personal and corporate. He put the two together, as if I remember right. And I think you're getting that. Plus the fact that, to put it in you know, self-interest terms for companies, Trump has been unable to deliver on the corporate tax cuts, which everybody was expecting. Okay, there's been a lot of deregulation, which has helped some industries and some particular companies. But in general, you know, Trump is not being seen as very good for business in the United States. And this, again, to go on from what John was saying, is a complete change from the usual Republican relationship with the business community.
You also get the sense, I think, that there's a lot of creaking around the sinking ship Trump, and people are not too keen to jump on board. The head of Merck, of course, one of, I believe, only four black CEOs in the Fortune 500.
Yeah. And the only one on the council.
And the only one on the council. Right. And his statement is specifically all the stuff about, you know, not condemning white supremacists. Of course I'm going, effectively, which is entirely understandable. And I don't see many other black businessmen leaving Ford to take his place.
Yes. And I think, I mean, to answer your question, Andrew, that, you know, increasingly being seen with Trump is less and less of an advantage, if it ever was one, and can obviously have negatives, and in purely corporate terms, have negatives with the image of your company, your relationship with suppliers, and above all, of course, with consumers, and your own position in the business community, which goes well beyond relationship with the president.
Absolutely. It also leaves the remaining CEOs on the business council with a very difficult question. You've had all these people resign because they oppose Trump's effective support for white supremacy. Does that mean you support white supremacists?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, John, you speak there, and it is one of the questions about Trump, about his support for white supremacists. Do you get the impression he actually has active white supremacist sympathies, or does he just not care that some of his fans do?
That's very hard to say. My guess is that, yes, he does have some sympathies, but as I said at the beginning, the big thing isn't his own sympathies. They're those of Steve Bannon, who has the office around the corner, who comes and bang on his door when things like this happen.
I mean, he is on record for quite a lot of his life of having espoused various dingbat theories about the innate, you know, superiority of certain genes. But again, it's very hard to know whether these are representative, where Trump is concerned, of any coherent worldview at all, or whether, and this is my personal suspicion, things just pop into his head and he says them.
I think things just pop into his head. We've had plenty of examples of that ever since he started running. But, you know, to pick up the B word, Steve Bannon, which John was mentioning, I think it's not just when something pops into his head, but it's when Bannon is has got his ear and so on. And, you know, all the evidence is that he's one of those people who reacts to the last person in the room who spoke to him. And if that person kind of caters to an inbuilt prejudice there, which he may keep hidden a lot of the time, it brings it out. And so we get what we got in the last few days.
The supremacist protesters we saw in Charlottesville are the kind of people who don't tend to bring out the best in their political opponents. And indeed, that has been the case. We've seen protesters in Durham, North Carolina, pulling down a Confederate memorial. It probably won't be the last, one wouldn't think, of such vigilante acts. North Carolina's governor, Roy Cooper, himself a Democrat, did sort of make noises about the fact that, you know, this isn't legal or anything, and said that there are better ways to remove these statues. Should authorities like him, I guess, be absolutely rigid, John, in ensuring that if these statues are going to go, they go in an orderly and lawful manner?
I don't know about absolutely rigid, but it's right to take a firm stance on this. I mean, statues are put up for a purpose, and this one was to commemorate the Confederate dead, of whom there were a great many in that state. It wasn't particularly sort of a politically slanted statue, I don't think you can allow people to simply go around pulling statues down because they don't like them. If you start that, where does it end?
Yeah, I mean, to sound terribly middle-of-the-road, bleeding-heart liberal, as no doubt Trump would say, you've got to do all you can to prevent a kind of escalation of violence and hatred that is clearly there between the alt-right, the neo-Nazis, and their opponents on the left. And when that starts to spiral and get out of control, then I think you are in a quite a dangerous position.
We'll close on this, but I'll ask each of you in turn, John, first, a question which I feel like I have asked at least once every single day that Donald Trump has been in office. But is this the point at which he either is or begins to become actually critically toxic?
I think we've probably already passed that point. I think we're slowly sliding down the slope. Losing key businessmen, effectively, you know, the disintegration of your business council is a damning indictment of any president, particularly Republican one. His poll ratings speak for themselves. The man is getting increasingly hysterical in his tweets. I see the exit door opening.
Jonathan?
Yeah, and, you know, you had John Kelly coming in as chief of staff, when was it, 10 days ago now, supposedly going to establish order in the White House. Well, we see the problem with establishing order in the White House is you've got to discipline the one man you can't discipline, who's your boss.
They just never gave Scaramucci a chance, did they? We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with John Everard and Jonathan Fenby. Coming up next, happy birthday, India and Pakistan.
Buckle up, put the armrest down and slide away that table. The third edition of The Escapist, Monocle's annual travel-focused journal, has landed. Our editors and bureau chiefs offer you their take on those far-flung places where opportunity and great design find a home. We head to Semmering in Austria, a sleeping architectural beauty being gently awoken by an ambitious set of hospitality entrepreneurs. Then we take a drive down Turkey's liberal west coast and dust up on Broome's long history of welcoming new arrivals to Western Australia. Also, our culture editor, Rob Bound, sifts the treasure from the trash in Benidorm. We also reveal the winner of Monocle's third annual restaurant awards, as well as a crop of comfy new hotels in which to rest your head. The Escapist is your summer set piece, packed with the sunniest and smartest insights from leaders in the travel industry. The Escapist, on newsstands now.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are John Everard and Jonathan Fenby. On the stroke of midnight 70 years ago, give or take a few time zones, two newly independent nations were born, India and Pakistan. Any celebration of that anniversary is also, by definition, a commemoration of the horrors of partition. As many as 15 million people were displaced, more than a million killed, as the former British imperial possession pulled itself apart. 70 years later, the relationship between the two neighbours remains such that the Independence Day parties remain two fairly distinct occasions. Jonathan, first of all, Narendra Modi, India's Prime Minister, spent his Independence Day speech beating up on separatists in Kashmir. Was that entirely helpful?
No. Kashmir has not been helpful ever since 1947. To go back on the history, the ruler of Kashmir, who was Hindu, wanted to join India, but Muslim tribesmen invaded and practically overthrew him. The Indians then sent in the army, and there was a protracted war through 47-48, line of demarcation, supposed ceasefire, but this has continued as a confrontation and hostility ever since, and largely forgotten about, it must be said, occasionally flaring up. And certainly the best kind of tribute, the best tribute to what happened and all the deaths at the time of independence and partition would be a serious attempt to resolve that standoff in Kashmir. But we seem to be going in the opposite direction.
Jonathan, Modi said in his speech, unless he has been woefully misreported, that he believed that hugs could solve the problem in Kashmir. It hasn't been tried, to the best of my knowledge, but is this a possibly optimistic view?
I think it is wonderfully optimistic. I love the idea, the vision of these separatists and the authorities going around hugging each other. I mean, bring it on.
Yeah,
but sadly, I just don't see it. A nice thought, though.
Yes.
He did have some other fairly trenchant observations to make, as Modi often does, Jonathan. He criticised people for using religion to incite violence, which is a perfectly reasonable thing to criticise people for. It is a problem in India in all sorts of respects, as it frankly is in most places. But was he also taking a swipe at Pakistan there?
He was taking a swipe at Pakistan, but at the same time, you've had a rise of what one can only call Hindu fundamentalism under Modi. The RSS, the kind of extremist Hindu movement, has certainly become much more active. New state premier, who is extreme anti-Muslim, has been appointed, and so on. So it's, yes, there is the Islam, obviously, factor in Pakistan, but there's also a lot in India itself.
John, if we look at the relations between the two countries, which are not good and haven't been good by and large, and if we look at, an imaginable ideal comparison, say France and Germany, two former adversaries of many centuries standing, now who get along more or less all right, what's stopping India and Pakistan from reaching that point?
I think one of the big obstacles has been that the two countries have taken such very different paths. I mean, India has been admittedly slightly shambolic, but has maintained democracy interruptions granted for most of its independence.
Which is no small accomplishment.
Yeah, well,
for nearly all, that's right, yes. Was Pakistan, sadly, that can't be said for. And you've got a kind of imbalance there between the political systems of the two countries. Also, the security state is much more powerful in Pakistan than it is in India. The Indian intelligence service, the security services are powerful, but nothing compared to what the Pakistanis have relative to Pakistani central power. And it tends to colour the way that the Pakistani government as a whole sees the world. They're actually quite difficult to deal with.
I mean, the cynical question to ask, Jonathan, and I'm put in mind of on my one visit to Pakistan a long time ago now, circa 98, I think, but it was around the time that Pakistan first tested a nuclear weapon. I remember being extraordinarily struck by the immense pride in this achievement that many ordinary Pakistanis I met were taking. And these were Pakistanis, who lived in homes which did not have, indoor plumbing, clean water, electricity, in fact. So the question is the hostility possibly that little bit too useful to politicians on both sides of the border?
It is very useful indeed, and it has been from the very beginning. I'm sorry, I'm writing a book which brings this in, which is why I could go on about this all day.
Do you have a release date for it yet, Jonathan, that you would like to mention?
Next spring, summer it'll be. But first of all, it's very interesting from that point of view, historically, the comparison that you drew, because the roots of Franco-German understanding were actually being sown by the Americans under the Marshall Plan at the very point where India and Pakistan came apart. So you've actually got, a historical moment where this is happening. No, the answer is yes. And from the beginning, there was this hostility. The Indians, the Congress Party, thought Pakistan would collapse and soon beg to rejoin India. And Pakistan, as Jinnah, the founder, put it, was a moth-eaten entity from the beginning with no money, and where the army and Islam became much more important than Jinnah would have wished them to be.
Jonathan, is there any, I mean, are they completely, sorry, Jonathan, I meant John rather than Jonathan on this occasion, are they so completely far apart that any form of rapprochement is unthinkable?
No, I don't think that's true. I right now...
It's not North and South Korea, if we're stretching for comparisons.
It's not North and South Korea. I mean, rapprochement there may eventually be possible, who knows. But India and Pakistan, no, I mean, things are a bit tense at the moment, but both countries change, both countries develop, and it's not impossible that in the not too distant future you do get some kind of rapprochement.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we will look to Berlin, where the famously inventive German language may shortly have to coin a word for foreigners taking advantage of the fact that we all speak English, because we actually have a functional education system and an outgoing global outlook. German MP Jens Spahn has spoken of his exasperation at the monoglot English-speaking restaurant staff apparently plaguing Berlin, and his remarks have been widely applauded. Jonathan, we arrive here at the mantra, if you live here, learn the language.
Yes.
Now, is that just common sense, or is that just a thing xenophobes enjoy saying?
Well, it's both.
Possibly both.
It's both, I think. I would argue that it's both. I must say, having since my German has frayed away over the years, I do find it very useful when in Berlin that just about everybody seems to speak English there. But presumably what the MP is talking about is mainly immigrants and refugees who come from countries where English is the main language there. And I think, you know, I'm afraid it's a fact of life there that this is going to be the case.
The Germans have made efforts to make sure that language is learned by incomers, of which there have been many in the last few years. But how do they get to grips with the problem, John? And I know that this is a problem because various friends of mine who live in Germany, and these are people who've grown up in Britain or Australia or Ireland and are therefore English speakers, have moved to Germany. They've tried to do the decent thing and learn the language, but they point out that it's actually incredibly difficult to learn German in Germany, because as soon as you attempt your hapless German in some shop or some other public forum, the person you're speaking to will just wave you away and address you in absolutely perfect English.
Yes, I think there are elements of that. And one thing that's been pointed out in these articles is that you don't get this problem in France. Of course, if you go to France and try to speak English, you get a very different response. I don't know about, we're talking about xenophobes here, but anyway, there's a very different cultural reaction to the speaking of English.
Yeah, when I was in the Economist correspondent in Germany a few years back now, in the 80s and so on, and I'd been in Paris before, it was remarkable how if you did an interview with a French politician, it had to be in French, absolutely. In Germany, you would ask the first couple of questions in halting German, and they would then, like your friends, the politicians, all except for Gerhard Schröder, would reply in English and so on. And so you got into English, and it was very much easier, which was just as well for me, because my German was pretty lame, whereas I have a French wife, so my French was somewhat better.
I have a very vague memory of a few years ago an Australian newspaper running an equivalent of that New Statesman, famous New Statesman competition about bad advice to give people going overseas, and one of the winning entries being the suggestion that an Australian in France should never attempt to speak French because the French people so enjoy addressing Australians in English, and if one pretended not to understand you, the correct response was to seize them firmly by the shoulders and say, "Hey, mate, are you deaf or something?" John, but things like this, is it really a threat to German language and German culture if there is a generation of bartenders and baristas who cannot actually speak German? Is this just what happens when Berlin is, as Berlin has become, a global city? It speaks a global language.
No, I don't think there's a threat to German language, German culture. I think it's heavily localized. It is just, it's not just Berlin. You get the same in Munich.
Yeah.
But it's certain areas of certain big cities. You know, the great swathes of Germany are solidly German speaking. And if you go into almost any restaurant anywhere in what used to be East Germany and try to speak English, see what happens to you. No, I think the German language would like to survive.
Jonathan, is the question more we should be asking ourselves is why, and I speak as somebody who grew up on an English-speaking island, why countries like Australia, the United Kingdom, the United States don't make more effort earlier on with language education?
Yes, I mean, there's a very real question. The supremacy of the English language, really, ever since the end of the Second World War, has been, in a sense, very good for those who speak English, but has cut off probably a lot of understanding among people in those countries of foreign cultures. And you know, you read books in translation. It's very rare that you would read a book in the original language in English.
See, it's the result of lots of poorly educated, ignorant people just charging around the world, yelling at the locals in English until they got the message.
And that, of course, fits in with this wave we've got at the moment. There are too many tourists. Too many people are going on holiday. You know, this is unfair. And a lot of them speak English.
Well, that brings us to the end of today's show. John Everard and Jonathan Fenby, thank you very much for joining us at Midori House. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Helena Jarit. Our studio managers were Kieran Banerjee and David Stevens. More music next, our design show, Section D at 1900, and I'll be back with more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thank you for listening.